hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in. It's early 2025, but plans are already underway for the 2026 midterm elections and the 2028 presidential election. I'm not talking about candidates padding their war chests or campaign operatives figuring out the best messaging. I'm talking about the plans for actually running the election. I've said it many times. There's never an off year for elections. That's especially true if you work at the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. I'm guessing most people have never even heard of the Election Assistance Commission, or EAC. It's a crucial federal agency that helps to make our election system fair and secure. And its work never stops. Here to discuss the inner workings of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission is Ben Hovland, who is one of the four commissioners on the EAC and is currently serving as its chair. Ben, welcome to Democracy Optimist. So first, tell us what the EAC is. I know its history actually goes back to Bush v. Gore in 2000 and the Help America Vote Act in 2002, a federal law that created the agency. Fill us in on some of that history.
Well, thanks for that. And you're exactly right. We are not a household name for most people, but you're right. We were created by the Help America Vote Act, which was Congress's response to the Florida 2000 election, essentially. And we were created to be an independent bipartisan agency. And we were given four primary mission areas. First, we test and certify voting equipment. We give out federal grant money to the states. We also conduct something called the Election Administration and Voting Survey, or EAVES, which is the only national survey of its kind that looks at how Americans are engaging in the process, how they're participating. And by that, I mean how they're getting registered to vote. Is it that at a motor vehicle office? Is that online? Is that through a third-party group? How they're voting? Is that mail? Is that early in person? Is that on election day? We even see what the average age of poll workers are out of that study. And so it's very valuable for data-driven decisions and for policymakers. And then finally, Congress charged us with being a clearinghouse of best practices. With each state running elections a little differently, we were basically asked to look across the states, take that national perspective, and identify those things that can be helpful for other states or other jurisdictions to better serve their voters.
So it sounds like the work was really crucial in 2020 when we had the pandemic election. And then, of course, we had the 2024 election as well, both with higher turnout historically than we've seen in previous elections. Tell us a little bit about the work of the EAC in supporting election administrators and supporting states in running those two past presidential elections in particular.
You know, it has been an interesting time to be in election administration, to say the least.
Interesting time to study it as well.
2020, again, an election like we'd never seen, with the global pandemic taking place, with people having, with election administrators having to shift how they were going to administer elections. So a couple things that really stick out in my mind about that election. First, the EAC distributed $825 million in grants to the states. Some of that was HAVA security grants, and some of that was CARES Act funding to help specifically around the pandemic. But again, allowed people to make sure that poll workers were safe, that election officials were safe, get things like PPE, but also adjust some of the processes. Again, we knew with the pandemic, more people would be voting by mail than ever before, and that turned out to be true. Similarly, we were able to really lean into that clearinghouse function. I was looking at it, time has flown. But looking back on it, I was able to record a video with three election officials who had been in mail-driven states, but had been there through that transition. People who had started as, you know, running basically a traditional polling place model, but moved to a vote-by-mail model. And they were able to share tips, you know, very pragmatic tips about what that transition looked like, lessons learned from that, and give examples of ways that things that would help their colleagues around the country who now were going to do this in a matter of months compared to the years that those folks had to do the transition. And so that was a really big deal to be able to share those best practices across the country, really take advantage of federalism in that case and share and use those differences to our advantage. And finally, you know, while more Americans than ever voted by mail, a lot of Americans still wanted to vote in person, and it was important to have that option. But to do that, you need poll workers. And, you know, we saw in some of the early primary states right after sort of the shutdown for the pandemic, you know, massive shortages of poll workers, and it was a big deal. So we launched something called National Poll Worker Recruitment Day, and really, you know, helped to recruit a new generation of poll workers, educate people about this need for people to be a poll worker, let people know that this was a way they could serve their communities. And so those are a few that really stick out from 2020. And of course, you know, the time between 2020 and 24, we saw a whole new threat landscape and challenges for the elections community. And so the EAC had to adapt to that. You know, some of the things that we've been working on in the last couple of years are really to support people for the 2024 election. We're looking at communications resources and tools. You know, whenever you're doing things at the 50 state level or the national level, you know, it's really hard to do a one size fits all. So we've really focused on things like toolkits or templates that can be customizable. So we can do some of that work, recognizing that so many local offices, you know, maybe don't have a dedicated communication staff or don't have, you know, the ability to do some of that graphic design work. And we can have a customizable template that then they can put in the information on their website or how to get to, you know, where you get registered or what the registration deadline is or other important information for voters to have and really help with that trusted source communications effort. But we also, you know, have seen a significant turnover. So we did more with training than we've ever done before and also recognized that there are things that are really critical to do sort of no matter what, like continuity of operations planning and providing templates and guidance around that. And we certainly saw that pay dividends in a year that had major weather impacts, whether that was the hurricanes, we saw flooding, we saw tornadoes, we saw a lot of weather all over the country. And so, again, we continue to think through ways to provide those resources to support election officials as they run elections.
So what are you doing in a so-called off year now as we get moving to 2026 in the midterms and the 2028 elections? I saw that you kind of laughed when I said off year because, right, there is no off year from your perspective.
That's exactly right. I mean, there is no off year. You know, so many, you know, that's such a misconception that people have about elections is that, you know, oh, well, what do you do the other 364 days a year or things of that nature? And, you know, the reality is election administration is a year-round job. The difference is in those so-called off years, that's certainly when election administrators have more time, if you will, to implement new programs, to think about new programs. So I mentioned the clearinghouse resources that the EAC provides. You know, this is that moment where people really might be looking at those or thinking about implementing those. So certainly we're supportive in that area. But also there are things I mentioned, our testing and certification requirements. We created a new standard a couple years ago called the voluntary, or it's the overall standard is the Voluntary Voting System Guidelines, which is a mouthful. Well, we did a new standard of that in 2020. But this year, we'll see the first equipment certified to that standard. So We'll see a new generation of voting equipment starting to emerge, which is great. You know, there's advanced requirements on that around security, accessibility, usability. Again, really a leap forward, which we're excited to see that sort of come out. And so we'll be talking about that. We're very close to certifying the first electronic poll book that the agency's ever certified in a new program that we created around election supporting technology. So there's a lot going on, even in a so-called off year.
So all of this discussion is part of this idea in the way in which we run elections, in that there's not a federal agency that actually administers the election. Your agency, the EAC, helps states run elections. I often say that, you know, we don't really have one election day. We have 51, or include the territories, 50 some odd election days that all happen at the same time. And actually, we have thousands of election days that all happen at the same time, because local jurisdictions are really the ones on the ground that run elections. And your agency is there to facilitate, right? So do you think this is a good model? I mean, should we have an agency like yours that actually administers the election, or does it work to have a federal agency that is, you know, just sort of facilitating and helping the states in their work?
So over the course of my career, I've probably done, you know, several 180s on this, and I've worn different hats and been in different roles, whether it was at the Missouri Secretary of State's office or the U.S. Senate, you know, and I've thought about this in a lot of different ways. But I think where I've really come to, and certainly the EAC, in my opinion, reflects this, is to embrace that federalism. It is what we have, you know, certainly with the federal government. And I think there's a place for federal floors, and we've seen that over the years. But they're really, you know, if you embrace the federalism, if you embrace those differences, there really are a lot of benefits. You know, I mentioned what we saw during the pandemic and how we were able to learn and utilize some of the lessons learned from the vote by mail states. But there's so many areas like that, and really, again, that's what the clearinghouse function of the agency was designed to be. We are a largely non-regulatory agency. I say that we're a customer service agency. And so much of that is thinking through, you know, how can you serve election officials? How can you make their job better? How can you provide something that is useful to them to ultimately better serve their voters? And when we look out across the states, you know, there are all these real world experiments happening where we can see what the impact is or how people engage in these processes. And in our states and our communities, you know, often have different histories and different cultures. And, you know, we see in the West, you know, we certainly have seen people lean into to vote by mail more with broader geographies and, you know, some of the distances that, you know, where you have counties that are bigger than entire states. That might be pragmatically the best way for them. And then certainly, you know, we have some of the more traditional models in the Northeast, and you have some states that are, you know, sticking with mostly Election Day voting. And then you have people who have really embraced things like early voting and vote centers. And so to be able to see that, to be able to track that, to be able to talk about that and the options, I think is a big deal to, again, provide options for policymakers to see how there are real world impacts for the voter experience with that.
So let's talk about the actual commissioners on the Election Assistance Commission and the way the agency is set up. You've got four commissioners, two Democrats, two Republicans. In a world where everything seems so polarized, that sounds like a recipe for gridlock and failure. How does it actually work in operation to have, you know, the two and two of Democrats and Republicans?
Yeah, certainly, you know, particularly in Washington, obviously, when you've got two and two, you know, when you're in a bipartisan situation, that does seem like a recipe to not get things done. But, you know, I think we've done a great job working together. I think we really focus on this concept that, you know, good election administration is about good governance and customer service. And you see election administrators around the country with that attitude. I can't tell you how many election officials that I've visited their offices, I've toured, I've talked to their staff, and I have no idea what party they are. And they may be elected officials and run on a partisan office, but their attitude toward their voters and how they serve their voters is in a nonpartisan way. And I think we've done a good job of focusing on that approach in my tenure. And I think that when you do that, there's a lot of common ground. You know, I remember when, so we're often paired up and passed through the Senate. And so Commissioner Palmer and I went through the Senate together through that process. And one of our first meetings once we were on the commission was with the National Association of Secretaries of State. And a secretary asked, you know, basically the question you asked of, you know, how are you not going to get bogged down in partisanship? And I said, well, you know, I think we'll do all the stuff that we agree on first, and then we'll take care of the other stuff. And the reality is, you know, there really is enough common ground that we haven't gotten to that other stuff yet. And that has, I think, served the agency well and ultimately election officials and the voters.
Yeah, and what you said echoes what I hear from local election officials all the time. I mean, you know, as an election law professor, I think it's crazy that the U.S. is the only modern democracy where partisan elected officials run our elections, and yet virtually all of them basically take their partisan hat off when it comes to the actual administration. Of course, there's always going to have stories of things you hear about, but these are dedicated public servants. And I think what you're saying is that we need to trust them. We need way more trust in our elections as a general matter. And your message seems to be that we can trust the people who are running our election system. And election trust gets me to another question, which is about turnout. So in 2024 nationwide, we had about 63% turnout for the presidential election. And I remember the next day after the election in November, there was these news stories about this massive turnout, and it was so strong and the second highest ever, second only to 2020. Is two-thirds or under two-thirds turnout acceptable? And of course, it's not even talking about primaries and midterm elections, et cetera, which is a lot lower. Well, what are your thoughts on the turnout question?
You know, I think that that's a really good question. It's certainly something that I've thought about a lot over the years. And what it really ends up boiling down to me, you know, turnout is a complicated thing, as you know. There's a lot of factors on that. A lot of that has to do with candidates and politics. And, you know, so there's that side of the House. For what I view as the election administrative side of the House, you know, where I focus, to me, again, back to that good governance customer service mantra, you know, if we provide the opportunity to vote, if you reduce the barriers or reasons that people can't participate, if Americans choose not to, that's also their right. You know, we're not a compulsory voting country. You know, Americans have that right to not to participate. I want them to. I clearly believe in it and think that people should. But what I'm concerned about is people who do vote having a good experience, people having the opportunity to vote if they want to, and they're not being hurdles or barriers that keep them from participating if they want to vote.
So are you optimistic about elections? You know, this is a show that's called Democracy Optimist in 2025. What's your take on that?
Yeah, and I certainly, you know, I love the title and I'm glad. I'm glad about optimism. I know that that can be a challenge at times. And again, you know, this is a space that very much gets muddled with politics. And I do think it's important for people to understand the distinction. You know, I use this metaphor. I think a lot of times when people cover election administrations, the same reporters that cover politics. And so it sometimes looks like a horse race, or they try to make it seem like a horse race. And to me, election administration is the track, and you got to make sure it's taken care of and it's smooth and people can run that fair race. And ultimately, you know, I think that I am an optimist about that. And I think when you look at the ways that we've improved election administration in the last handful of years. Again, that good governance, customer service idea that I keep coming back to. We've seen an expansion of voting options. You know, you see more no excuse absentee or mail ballots. You see things like vote centers and early voting. You know, we're finding more ways to engage people or give them the opportunity to participate in a way that works for them. And so much of that didn't exist just a few years ago. So while there are challenges, while there are difficulties, you know, certainly I think we've seen a lot of progress. And I am hopeful for our democracy and election administration broadly.
Ben Hovland is the chair of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. Ben, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me. Great to join you.
Josh, you say it all the time that every vote matters, and sometimes it can matter to the point of deciding an election. So if you would tell us about what happened in Corpus Christi, Texas, earlier this year.
Yeah, you just never know when your vote could be the one that decides a close election, especially in a local race. Corpus Christi voted for a city council seat in November 2024. None of the five candidates received a majority, so the election went to a runoff in December. That runoff ended in a tie. Each candidate received exactly 1,916 votes. A recount confirmed the tie. So election officials had to figure out what to do. State law says that to resolve a tie, officials should determine the winner through a game of chance. Local officials in Corpus Christi can decide which game of chance made the most sense for them. They actually spent 3 days in meetings trying to decide the best way to do it. As reported by VoteBeat, some members of the public were quite perplexed. VoteBeat quoted one local resident as saying, "What's next, a giant rock, paper, scissors tournament to find out who will be the next mayor?" After the 3 days of meetings, Corpus Christi officials decided to have the candidates each draw one of 10 small numbered beads from a box. The candidate who drew the bead with the higher number would be declared the winner. To determine the order of drawing the beads, the candidates rolled the die on the table at the same time. The higher number went first. Then they drew the beads. One candidate drew a bead with a 2 on it. The other one had a 3 and was declared the winner. Perhaps it's unorthodox, but when the result is a tie, a game of chance is perhaps better than the alternative, spending the time and money to run another election. But if one additional person had voted in Corpus Christi, Texas, then one of the candidates actually would have had a majority.
A lot has happened since President Trump took office on January 20th, to say the least. And whether one supports him or doesn't, it's undeniable that he has worked pretty quickly to change the way federal government runs. How should those who declare themselves to be a democracy optimist respond to this?
Yeah, it is hard to keep up with the news, and you're correct that a lot has changed already. Elections have consequences, of course, and the courts are already issuing rulings on some of Trump's decisions. But none of this negates the power of bipartisan local reforms and the power of stronger civics education and an engaged citizenry. We just need to double down in our efforts to strengthen our democratic processes, and that can start at the local level. We also have to have a conversation about changing the way we approach civics education. So my advice is not to throw up your hands and do nothing, whether you like what's happening or not. Being a democracy optimist is about hope for the future. Hope can spur action, and you can start that work in your local community.
Well, one of the themes in this series is that voters themselves can help to support democracy, and that includes getting accurate information about the voting process. What's one thing people can do to arm themselves with reliable information about our elections?
Our guest, Ben Hovland, mentioned the publication that the EAC publishes every 2 years. It's a comprehensive guide to the previous election called the Election Administration and Voting Survey, or EAVES. The EAC compiles data from all 50 states, D.C., and 5 U.S. territories about the ways Americans voted and how these jurisdictions administer their elections. The guides are chock full of interesting information about voter turnout, methods of voting, military and overseas voters, and more. And the data is sometimes broken down to the county level. It's a great tool for anyone who is interested in learning more about how our elections actually work, coming from a reliable, nonpartisan source and written in an accessible way. Check it out at eac.gov and click on Research.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.